Hello everyone, a very happy new year and welcome to the very first episode of 2023 of Yes Sir HR. As usual, my name is Mark and I'm with...
Yeah, you're with Dennis and I'm still here in the UK until next week.
Right, so how was the Christmas, New Year slash celebrations in the UK?
Yeah, good. Stayed in Jersey, had a... well, didn't drink too much and kept it nice and simple, but yeah, pleasant.
Nice. Okay, so in Singapore it was a bit quirky weather, I must say. Some days it was scorching hot, other days it was just raining non-stop. Yeah, so we are winding up the celebrations and we're back to work tomorrow actually. And we are recording this on the 2nd of January, so back to work on the 3rd. I believe it's also a public holiday in Jersey today. Okay, so then we're going to do something different. Since it's the new year, we're going to do something different. Usually, if you have been a loyal fan of the show, and I mean loyal fan of the show, you will know that at the end of every podcast, we usually introduce a little tool, e-tool, or a book, or a video that we found interesting. So we thought that we'll do something different for the first episode this year. And we will use this e-tool as the basis for our discussion. Okay, so I'm not sure if you have come across this newspaper article or whether you have read something about this or whether is it a big thing in the UK then. But in Singapore, it's suddenly starting to take hold. And I'm talking about this AI, artificial intelligence-driven tool called ChatGPT by OpenAI. Now, what exactly is ChatGPT? Now, when you did your master's degree then, can you remember when you did your master's degree?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, funny enough.
Was it painful when you had to go to the library to go and look at old dusty journals, pull them out, looking at references and so forth? Do you find that painful?
I'll tell you what was, yeah, that was one aspect of it. But the hardest aspect was when I did mine, it wasn't quite the Stone Age, but I didn't have any great typing skills. And fortunately, right. I didn't know somebody. I had some pain. It probably cost me, about over $1,000. And I used to write out, and my writing wasn't that great. And I'd have to drive to her accommodation, give it to her, she'd type it up. And this went on. This is my final dissertation thesis. I think it went on for about 3 months. Backwards and forwards, typing it, proofing it. Whereas now, we would do it on the computer and you can have Grammarly and all these other things.
Right.
It was a
process.
Right. So you are familiar with tools like Grammarly. You know, you can now reference using Bibliotext and so forth and all that, right?
I'm familiar with them, unfortunately. when I published my last book, I didn't have those tools. So I had to do a lot of hours and hours of proofreading and whatever. Yeah. So there's probably, if I look back on that, if I took that book, I don't think there's any significant spelling aspects, but probably a few linguistic points could have been improved. However, I did write the book with two things in mind. One, to make it very scientific, very comprehensive, but also write it in a more informal genre. So I wasn't too worried about being over pristine all the time, but obviously I didn't want, there's a sort of significant typing errors or things like that. So, but yeah, certainly today I would use. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what if I told you that right now it has gone even, the technology has gone even one step further, and that's ChatGPT. Now imagine if you are a master's student or any student who has been given an essay to write, maybe on like global warming. The AI today allows you to essentially just type a question or tell the ChatGPT what you need information on or write a topic on, and lo and behold, in just a few taps, you get a whole paragraph of stuff that you can use in your essay. So, and actually, it's quite amazing because it is not clunky in the sense that it is not believable. It is very believable. And in fact, certain teachers have now actually started to lose their minds a little because they are worried that students, and I'm pretty sure that our students are way ahead, they probably already knew of this technology and are already turning in essays on topics, okay, that they have been told to write. And here's the clincher. You don't even need to, all you need to do is just type in some keywords, give the AI some suggestions, and it churns it out for you. And apparently, it is so original that it is also difficult to detect on anti-plagiarism software. Now, before we go into the discussion, I just want to get your thoughts on what you think this tool is. How mind-blowing is this tool?
Well, massively, Mark. I mean, there's a couple of points that I think need to be made. That I'm looking at the UK curriculum. Previous podcast that the UK curriculum has come under massive criticism for not being sufficiently focused to real world applications and bulky teaching a lot of stuff that's not relevant, right? So there's a definite need to prune down what's being taught. Now, if we start to say, hold on a minute, what is really important to learn? The kind of notion I would have is that a lot of what is presently being taught in the curriculum is not particularly useful. I'm not going to get too politically spun on this. What we are now in the position with these tools is that students are able to access this information, make it more meaningful, and then we can start to learn better about how we can live our lives better, relationships, and do something sensible to making sure that this planet might survive more than 100 years before we destroy it. So there is a real opportunity, and if we connect it to what we're about enhancing teacher expertise globally, right? And that's what we've done, you know, the last sort of couple of decades, training to learning, doing research, and been fortunate enough to in Singapore. And more I think about, more I see the importance of better teaching with better learning and better thinking. And collectively, if we had this, you imagine all over the world, if most teachers were teaching students to think better, to self-regulate better, to understand of the world, is might just end up with a significant improvement in, you know, the existential position of Homo sapiens, you know, in the universe, if you like. I mean, it's that kind of powerful, I think. So, I mean, that's what kind of doing stuff. So, yeah, let's use these technologies, not just as kind of aids to get through exams and avoid plagiarism, but to develop better thinking with a better perspective globally. So I think it's massive.
Right.
Keep us busy the next 2 years.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I think it might be futile trying to prevent. So I've been reading a lot of articles saying, oh, we should ban it and we should put punitive measures for students who use these tools to try and game the system. But I've also seen one or two, and not many, teachers who say, why do we not embrace this technology? But exactly what you just said, but help students to think more rationally, be better thinking students, help them to self-regulate, so that they can use this technology for good. And I want to, and I think we should have this discussion now. And I'm going to frame this and do what we do best, which is really to talk about how we can do that from an evidence-based approach. Okay, and specifically the context would be is how do we make use of such technology and tools, which is going to, you know, going to get even, for want of a better word, better in the future. So how can we make use of that to design and facilitate online and blended learning more from an evidence-based approach? So I'm going to start off with this contextualizing statement, and then I want you to share with me your thoughts, because I think we've been talking about this for a long time, and we did allude to one or two episodes, but I don't think we have gone into depth. So, and I just want to build with what you just said. So here's the contextualizing statement. Now, edutech does not change the fundamental ways in which the brain works. Now, I think that's an important point, and I need you to elaborate on that a little bit. Yep. And therefore, our focus must be on what the different e-tools can specifically do to enhance aspects of the learning process. So that is the contextualizing statement. So there's two things that I need you to do for the people who are listening. Number one, what do you mean when you say edutech does not change the fundamental ways in which the brain works? Okay, and what does it mean when we say you need to make use of it to focus on the learning process? Have we not been doing that already? So let's go back to the first question first.
Yeah, well, I remember many years ago when I went to Singapore, I think it's about, we're talking 28 years ago, and there was a big buzzword flying around where we were working. You know, there was online learning. It's kind of the best thing since sliced bread, and it's going to be a teaching learning revolution. And I always thought, well, yeah, look, there's a that technology can process lots of information. I mean, you go on a computer now and type Jack Russell dog, you get a million hits. Now, I mean, that's fast processing speed. And, you know, we work from an evidence-based point of view. And one of the big areas that we've researched and applied when we've trained teachers is, look, you've got to understand how the mind processes information. You can't simply download thousands of bits of information straight into neural networks in the brain. When we can do that, we won't need teachers, will we? I mean, you imagine you want to learn to speak Mandarin or Czechoslovakian or whatever, and you could just have some kind of zap straight into your brain, and all those neural networks are there, all the vocabulary is there, the understanding of the syntax is there, and the ability to use tone. That's going to stop teachers standing in front of the classroom showing PowerPoint slides, or irrespective of what they do. So, but that's not actually the case at the moment, right? Yeah. So the brain takes many, well, probably millions of years and certainly thousands of years to change in any significant way. I mean, research has shown that certainly we can say without any doubt that our brain today, Homo sapiens, is no different in any significant way than what it was 50,000 years. Go back to 2000 years and there were no computers then. There were, you know, it was kind of people learned what they needed to learn by word of mouth from parents. So if you're in an hunter or gathering society, you learn, you know, what animals that you could kill and what animals could kill you, and ways to keep the animals that can kill you out of your cave or wherever or camp on, and what animals you could kill and eat that didn't poison you. So there wasn't too much to learn, right? So our brain working memory, which we know as a very limited capability, was perfectly suited. Unfortunately, today, there's so much to learn, we can't process it, right? So our brain isn't, you know, all this nonsense that's been spilling around about, you know, young people today, their brains are different, they learn differently. It's nonsense that's been talked about, digital natives and digital immigrants. Again, it's all kind of, you know, like learning styles, it's kind of fluff. Youngsters today are good at using social media, not because there's some genetic development in their brains, because they're using it hours and hours and hours a day. And that's why they're good on gaming. But you ask them to repair their computer and it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it? So let's start with the fact that the human brain, unless a massive engineering tool, is going on, you know, it's green technologies, isn't it? Genetics, robotics, all of these things come together, create what is so a will, a singularity. This will change, but it massive biological technological change that puts revolution is far beyond any 19th century England, right? But we're not there yet. Yep. So in the meantime, we're still
this information,
all this knowledge growing.
Knowledge growing.
And as teachers, we can't keep bigger and bigger. You can't put a pint in
half a pint of spillage.
To make the analogy worse, imagine
you're going to get even
more spinny, so you can't do it. You've got to work with the brain as it is. Fundamental point.
We have to say to ourselves that bypass working memory, long-term memory,
and
structure, learning environments,
how do we develop
instructional strategies
to maximize the brain
working
memory.
To learn stuff that is most
neurons
that are most useful to
a better understanding of the world in which we live.
So
that's the big anchoring point there.
And okay. So what about
the change? Change the way we eat. That I see technology having the impact.
Okay, so that sets that part straight. Now, what about specifically, we need to make sure that the different e-tools can enhance the aspects of the learning process. So can you elaborate a little bit about what you mean when you say the learning process?
Well, the way it works is quite simple. I mean, it's it's awesomely simple conceptually. It's a bit like that. Let's use bringing a bit of humour and that contextualisation of football. Football's an awesomely simple game, Mark, and I have noted that Manchester United have gone above Spurs in the league, and I notice you've not rubbed it in yet, so I thought I'll make it explicit so you can't indulge yourself later on in the show. But it's an awesomely simple game, as I think Brian Clough, it's somebody like that, the late Brian Clough said, well, you get the ball and you pass it and you attack the other goal and you try to score goals, and if you do, that's good. And when you haven't got the ball, you get it back, and then you do the same thing again. Now, the question is, I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo, who did play for Manchester United, I think he's going to, is it Saudi Arabia? And I think he's being paid something like, is it £200 million, right? That's a lot of money for kicking a ball around, isn't it? So it's an awesomely simple game, but when you do it really well, you tend to earn a lot of money. Now, coming back to our kind of analogy with sort of teaching, at the end of the day, it's the learning process is quite simple. You've got to get information from the external world into your brain that is sufficiently structured and cemented into long-term memory as a neural network. And it's really about that. For example, if you saw the film Slumdog Millionaire, where the Indian lad wins it and people question it, say, well, how can this guy who's a kind of street kid know that? It was just that all those questions that come up, it's a bit like winning the lottery, isn't it? Someone has to win it. And you have to get all those numbers. Well, he just happened to have had experiences. Like, there's one in the subway where somebody gives him, where he finds a dollar bill and recognises it was George Washington or whoever. And it stuck in his brain. So he just happened to have those neural networks around all those questions, right? So that's the point, is that all learning has to firstly be perceived, apprehended, connected to some prior knowledge. I mean, I can't remember the guy's name, but once he recognised that was a note, and you know, he knew the Indian currency had a note, and he recognises that figure, it becomes processed, right? So all to go through that process, people need to pay attention, take in information, make sense of it, and that's where the thinking process comes in, and that's what's so important about thinking. Thinking and memory are two sides of the same coin. So you've got to take the information, connect it to something in your brain, and then it's almost a Piagetian thing of, well, it accommodates. And that's how we build up learning. So if you're learning to play, you know, tennis, the guitar, understand philosophy, whatever it is, you've got to take in information, you've got to keep building these neurons that give you a better understanding and increasingly better picture of that reality. And if there's skills involved, develop applying that knowledge to the development of the skills at the technical level. Now, football's fortunate, there isn't too much to learn about football. That you've got to score in the right goal, unlike the Leicester player yesterday against Liverpool, or the day before, manages to kick two in his own goal. Only Liverpool could be that unlucky. I'm going to get some opprobrium for saying they seem to have this incredible ability to be fortunate in games. All right, they're a good side anyway. But going back to our point here, is that you've got to get that information stored in long-term memory. And that takes a lot of effort. And this is the problem. Our brain is quite lazy. We don't like to do too much thinking. And that's why so many people have such a very limited view of most aspects of reality. And it's not their fault that, you know, me and you, intelligently about education and football, but I don't think we could do 56 podcasts on ballet, do you? You know what I mean? So, you know,
we can do 57.
We are novices. All I know is that people can seem to stand on their toes. I do quite well to walk around on my feet now, you know, let alone do that. And so that's the key point, that learning is about taking in information, well, stimulus, making sense of it, connecting it to prior knowledge, and with effort over time, building better understandings and, in terms of skills, better skills. This often takes massive effort, and that's why a lot of people don't do it. And that's as simple as that. So we're never going to get away at the moment unless we can start, you know, kind of downloading information straight into the brain, and it creates neural networks. Well, that's very clever. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, we've only got to go back a few hundred years, and people were traveling around on horses at 20 miles an hour, and that was pretty fast. We've now got a space shuttle that will do 1,000 miles in an hour. Yeah. So until we get to a stage where we can download information straight into the mind and summit, all these neural networks grow, and hey, presto, I can speak Mandarin now, you know, in 5 seconds perfectly. Now, that may happen further down the line, but it ain't going to happen now. So people have got to go through the working memory, taking in small bits, processing it. Obviously, in any area of learning, like for us, if we read a book on education, we can read that book in, you know, a 20th at a time as somebody who doesn't know much about education, because as we read it, we can immediately see what we already know. And, you know, we find anything that's new. And often I might look at a book now in education or psychology and say, well, I know that. So I can literally skim. Ask me to assemble something that I've got to put, you know, a wardrobe. And I can spend 3 days, and, you know, by that be damaged most of the parts because I don't understand most of the instructions. So that's the way learning works. So what we've got to say to ourselves is, how can technology tools, platforms, et cetera, help us to use that working memory much, much better so that we can learn better stuff, at least much more efficiently? And I think that's the short-term goal.
Right. So that sets up the first nice point that I think we are trying to make when we talk about using e-tools for in a more evidence-based teaching approach way. And that is design or plan the lesson based on evidence-based practices and principles. For example, e-tools or methods that work best and consistent with how humans learn. And of course, we have talked about that through our core principles of learning.
Absolutely.
Can you give an example of an e-tool that you use quite regularly and why you use it? And because it is consistent with how humans learn?
Yeah, well, I mean, just a very obvious one that pretty much anybody who's working in education will be familiar with. If you take a tool like Kahoot, and Kahoot is part of a genre of tools, isn't it? About kind of communication, collaboration, assessment and feedback. And that kind of tool provides an opportunity in a fun environment, which is good for, you know, for students. It makes it more interesting by being fun. And you can, if you ask the right kind of questions, not just silly, factual, obscure questions, but key concept questions, you can see what students actually understand. So if you can probably find that in a topic, there might be 6 or 7 key concepts, and you can have questions that really hit those concepts. And in that immediate real life situation, see what students know, what they don't know, and with good facilitation skills. And that's where the skill of teaching and good questioning and getting students to think really comes into play, is to find out what students don't know and unpack. Are they lacking a piece of factual knowledge? Have they not developed sufficient conceptual understanding? In other words, to pull together some key concepts so that they've actually got a real working picture in their mind. I mean, for example, a good football coach like me and you, you know, we're not going to get jobs managing the Premier League because we didn't play at that level. But, you know, to visualize that when you're playing against a certain team, that they've got certain strengths and they're going to do certain things. So you've got to set your team formation up in this way. And this person's got to do a man-to-man marking there, or a woman-to-woman marking, or whatever it is. That's the understanding. And what we're trying to do with our teaching is to develop good understanding effectively and efficiently. So that e-tool is able to diagnose where students are, and then you can then make the interventions to fill those knowledge gaps, develop that conceptual understanding, and then link new knowledge to it very precisely. So you're increasing effectiveness and efficiency. And we know, you know, about learning, that when students are seeing that they are actually learning, they're achieving some mastery, that actually then feeds the motivational system. It kicks in a bit of dopamine in the brain and it keeps it going. Whereas if students are lost and confused, instead of getting dopamine, you're getting cortisol in the brain, right? Which actually turns you off. And that's why, historically, from my experience, a lot of students didn't do well in maths, because once you get lost in maths, you're lost in maths. You know, to sit in a class and look at calculus or even factorization or differentiation, and all you're seeing is words on the blackboard and it makes no meaning, that's pretty demotivating for maths. I had that experience where I think I've said on the previous pods where I took O-level maths in 1968 and got a grade 9 on the Oxford board, and my Jack Russell dog, who sadly passed away about 6 months ago, would have fared no worse than me, you know, getting a grade 9. But then I was fortunate in the following year to have a teacher who understood that and was able to identify what we, not just me, most, pretty much everybody failed it, I think maybe everybody in that class, and then was able to start building up some of those key concepts. Now, with the technology, you imagine now, you could present on a Kahoot format some key questions and you get immediate responses, you can give feedback and plenty of retrieval practice, you can keep going back and doing it to assess learning. So plenty of the Kahoot will diagnose learning difficulties. It creates a sense of fun. It provides immediate feedback and it provides the opportunity for a lot of repeated practice so that that learning can get cemented in long-term memory. So there's an example of an e-tool that it's a number of aspects of the learning process that helps to build understanding.
Right.
But it won't make you skillful at football. You have to be on the football for kicking balls, right? So in a sense, how does technology come into skill development? Well, I remember learning to play tennis and I always wanted to have a lobster machine. Now, that's an old-fashioned tool. It's probably even more developed. And that is, it's a machine that fires balls over the net. So you don't have to keep going and picking them up and getting someone to knock them over. You can have 15 minutes of sustained practice with the lobster machine knocking the balls over, so
yeah,
you've got,
yeah,
then you've got your coach there saying, well, you've got to move this way. So that was, you know, that's how technology can help skill development. And now artificial intelligence is able to do a lot of complex data analytics to look at how teams play, how you're playing, your movement, your turning. So there is a bit of a revolution going on, but at the end of the day, we're not all going to be Erling Haaland overnight with technology.
I think there is some hope there. Okay, so I think, and I want to bring back what we talked about right at the very beginning, which is like the emergence of AI and ChatGPT as a tool that allows students to just input with a few clicks and input keywords to able to generate for you practically a whole essay. So one of the second points here that has been, that I think we have talked about and we want to emphasize, is we should be using such ed tech tools to strategically enhance specific aspects of the learning process across the design, planning, and facilitation of the learning event, which could be the lesson. Now, my suggestion is, instead of, and I want to emphasize this again, instead of really trying to fight this and saying, no, we should ban students from using it, I think we should change the way we look at how they learn and how they make use of this tool. So one of the things that I was thinking of, instead of telling students, no, you are being banned from using this tool, can we not then get them to use this tool to generate text quickly, more efficiently? Let's say on a topic that we are teaching, let's say on sustainability. And then after the AI has generated this, to then do two things. One, we can either get students to defend what the AI has written, or two, to provide counter arguments to what the AI has generated, or even to have a debate based on what has been generated. Now, that to me then makes use of the technology, and at the same time, really getting students to interact with the technology, but more importantly, also getting them to practice self-regulation and deeper thinking. Does that make sense?
Well, 100%. Think about it. What is the objective? Let's be honest about it. We could start banning aeroplanes, couldn't we? And say to people, look, if you want to travel across the continent, learn to swim better. Now, you know, it's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Now, exactly what you said there is that as long as what we're not getting is students just getting lots of stuff, using the technologies, lumping it together and submitting a pretty looking piece of work. And, you know, with all the fancy Palmeroodle, that's an East London Jewish term, I think, for making it all look pretty. So it all looks very kind of pretty and nice. And there's plenty of stuff in there, but the student hasn't actually made any neural connections about real understanding and transfer and be able to apply it in real world context. But once they have to start debating it, there is questioning and then applying it to different contexts. So if we're looking at sustainability, once you understand all the different models, and you have got a good reference to the evidence for the different things that's going on, to be able to then say, well, hold on, if we're in Africa now, how would we apply this model or these models and this evidence to make that ecological environment work? Now, if they can do that, who cares whether they've spent 10,000 hours or 50 hours getting the information? If they can get that information, synthesize it, get the key concepts, and they're developing their thinking skills, which means that they will process information much, much better, then they've got real problem solving capability. Look, a very simple example, Mark, is that if you take discovery learning, you know, there are people out there talking about, oh, students have got to discover it for themselves. Well, hold on a minute. How many times have I tried to, even by sometimes going onto YouTube, learn to use a technology tool? And I spend 3 hours, I still can't learn it. Now, if something can teach it, if you were there with me, you'd teach it to me in 10 minutes because you know how to teach. And you would be saying to me, Dennis, what do you actually want to do with this tool? And then I'll tell you, and then you show me, and you don't miss out a stage, and you check that I'm with you. So it's the technology tools can make the learning process so more efficient, just like a very good map will get you from A to B as opposed to a poor map. So that's what, at the end of the day, it's still a person getting from A to B, but the technology tools, they can't get us there immediately. We're not going to turn our students into global eye-level thinkers overnight, but by them being able to get the best information, by developing their thinking skills, it's going to be a massive improvement on what we have.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, I think that's if everybody, you know, forgets everything that we have talked about, I think that's really the message that we want to send out. You can be creative. There is no point trying to fight these tools. But more importantly, I think try and use it in a more evidence-based manner, because we know, and I mean we as in collectively our listeners, know how students learn. We have been talking about it since 55 episodes ago.
And if you haven't, go back and re-listen to them. More you listen to them, more you'll get out of them. It's all there over 55 episodes. So that's where effort needs to come in. Don't be...
So that's the point, I think, is to really look at how we can embrace these tools to help students become better learners, become better thinkers, and to regulate themselves a little bit more. Which brings us to really point number three, and that is ensure that the completed or the learning designs that we have created maximizes the affordances of a range of learning modes, mediums, and methods to enhance learning effectiveness and efficiency. You want to take that and elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, well, basically, we know that we use our senses to learn, right? Okay. Yeah. And the most important ones for learning are probably visual. We are, you know, that was the thing that destroyed learning styles, this kind of visual, auditory, kinesthetic. We are all primarily, and that's part of our phylogenetic development are probably about 80% visual learners. Obviously, listening helps as well. And, you know, other senses like smell come into play. But if you're learning English literature, you don't need to use a lot of smelling, do you? You know, unless the book, you know, by Hamlet is about 200 years old and it stinks. You know, it's basically not a sense that we use so much for kind of educational learning. So what we need to do, we need to know that habituation is a problem to learning. So to say to someone, right, I want you to listen carefully for 2 hours is really, really difficult, right? So we want to design our lessons so that we are teaching the key concepts, very evidence-based point of view. And we're thinking about, well, is there a video? Is there a graphic? Is there a podcast? Is there some activity that will add variation, interest to the concepts or skills that are being learned? So that's the real skill. You know, when we talk about creative teaching, it's the ability to look at different methods, different activities, and sometimes even invent activities and connect things that might not seem to be immediately connected. Remember the example that I used when I was working with some lecturers on teaching Newton's second law of motion by using David Beckham taking a free kick by making the ball heavier, or David Beckham becoming stronger, how that affects the relationship between mass, force and acceleration. So it's being able to now use the technology tools to find all the, you know, like you're talking about this tool, being able to extract information, how you can pull down lots of resources and weave it together into a package. It's almost like making, you know, top chefs. Why do top chefs earn more money than people who can just slop something in a frying pan and say, we'll give it 10 minutes? It's that ability to look at all the ingredients that exist. Things that me and you, I mean, might not know about. I remember when I came to Singapore, and this is an analogy, I've just pulled it out of my head, is I remember being introduced to something that I subsequently knew become beef rendang. I'm looking forward to eating that in the next couple of weeks. And going to someone's house and having what I thought was a curry, because that was the nearest thing I could connect it to in my long-term memory, and say, wow, this is a great curry. What is it? And they said, no, it's not a curry, it's beef rendang. Now, I had no neurons in my brain. Beef rendang, what's that? So I Google it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it, and there was things like bois keros, candle nuts, and that is, in fact, bois keros in Malay is candle nuts, but I just saw bois keros. Don't know what that means. I leave that out. At various other things, and I bought some of the stuff and I chucked it in the pan, and it was pretty horrible. Even the dog wouldn't eat it, right? So but the top chefs have all these ingredients, and they can pull it together and say, right, we're going to do this type of dish, and they weave together this lovely dish. So creative teachers do that with resources, stories, humor, activities, presentation style, examples. And this is where technology can create that myriad of resources. And with hyperlinking, and there's hyperlink is probably the most powerful aspect of IT, you can link it in ways to differentiate, to make it deeper, broader. That's where the most creative teachers will be those who are pedagogically literate in terms of, you know, what we're dealing with in the program, you know, what teaching methods work best and why, what are the cognitive scientific principles, core principles of learning, how the brain works, and being able to say, well, given it works this way, this is our knowledge base, just like a top surgeon will know that field really well, and then be able to look at all the potential treatments as a surgeon, customize it to the patient. That's the gold standard, the adaptive expertise do with teachers, is be able to say, right, you're pedagogically literate, you know about the methods, you understand about how the brain works, the relationship between the mind and the brain, what you have to do. Now you've got technology that can just grab stuff from all over the world, and the skill of pulling it out and extracting it down to your course, and to be able to differentiate it, that is, you know, that's the Cristiano Ronaldo of teaching, isn't it?
Right. Okay. So I think
that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. It gives us, you know, something like a goal to aspire to. And I think it's also a timely reminder that we shouldn't be so seduced by every edutech tool that comes out that's a shiny little tool. And I know sometimes I'm guilty of it because I introduce almost every week a new tool that people can try out. But I think what I do that for is for people to really be creative in the way that they can use it to enhance the learning process for students so that they become... I think at the end of the day, it boils back down to two things, which we have talked about. One, help them become better thinkers. That's number one. And number two, help them to self-regulate themselves. So I think that's the two key major takeaways when we are trying to introduce new technology, whether is it on an online learning environment or whether we do it face-to-face. Fair enough?
Absolutely. And those two things are so synergistically related, because if you can get people to self-regulate in the wider sense, that means they know they have to make effort. You can't just, there's no simple solution to deep understanding, no simple solution to being good at tennis thinking or anything. You've got to be able to learn the underpinning concepts, the core structure of the subject. Then you've got to make massive effort with deliberate practice, right? It's as simple as that. So once you know that you have to do that, as you do that, then you would develop your thinking skills, right? Which feeds back. It's all part of that system. So if we get students to self-regulate, think better, hopefully that by thinking better, self-regulating better, they will be able to not just learn better, but have better well-being, because they will learn that life is hard, it's challenging, things go wrong, and you're going to suffer, and you have to learn to deal with that. We can't live in a world where students, you know, children are being told, oh, everything's all right, you know, nothing, you know, if something don't go right, oh, we can do something about it. Unfortunately, in life, you've got to suffer to do things, to get very fit. You've got to go in the gym, you know, no pain, no gain. Just walking around the gym for 2 hours and doing nothing doesn't get you super fit. That we all know that you have to put in a lot of effort, and sometimes life will throw you horrible things, illnesses, disease, you know, all these kind of things that you have to kind of fight against. And, you know, like we saw with COVID, it was a challenge. There was no simple solution. Unfortunately, collectively, the world did something that it doesn't do too often, and that is collaborate. Look how quickly we were able to, you know, collectively come up with a useful vaccine. Now, if it wasn't affecting everybody globally, it may have taken, you know, 10 years to do that or more. So, you know, if we had the world collectively working to deal with ecological problems, fighting wars, and trying to in some way develop better communication, collaboration, and, you know, value systems that seem to be more kind of existentially useful for meaningful, better survival, then we can achieve an hell of a lot. So those two things, self-regulation and thinking, they've got to be key educational aims globally.
Right. Okay. So which brings us more or less to the last part of the conversation. And that is, you have actually come up with a set of heuristics in really selecting the use of technological platforms or tools. And I think if you can, let's take that. I think you come up with three. Let's take them one by one and then see if we can help our listeners make that decision on which tool to use and not get distracted by the funness of it without really improving the learning process. So I think one of the things that you have said is, and I'm going to read this verbatim, in principle, if an edtech facility enhances any aspect of the learning process for the learning process for a group of learners, then there is potential use in terms of infusion into the instructional strategy. So essentially, what you are saying that as the first heuristic is, it must be used meaningfully. I think we know that. We have also said that it needs to help with the thinking process and it needs to help students regulate themselves. Is there anything else that we can add to that?
Well, that's the first thing. Look, yeah. Let's use an analogy here. Let's suppose we want to eat more healthily, right? Okay. So the first thing is we've got to ask ourselves, is this food likely to enhance our health in some way, right?
Yep.
if it doesn't at all, I mean, let's take smoking. I don't think anybody will now say that smoking cigarettes, I mean, is going to be good for your health. And that's why a lot of people don't smoke now, okay? But one could say that, oh, well, I enjoy smoking, so even though I increase my risk of lung cancer and various other things, I'd rather smoke and take that risk. Now, if you take, say, sport, right? If you're going to be a racing car driver, right? Yeah. You know, and if you're very good at it, you earn lots of money and you're very famous. And that, you know, one could say that's a very desirable existential state. However, driving a car at 200 miles an hour does run the risk of danger, does it? And that's why, you know, quite a few people have died as racing car drivers, right? So it's a choice that you make. So going back to the teaching analogy, if an e-tool like Kahoot, we know Kahoot can enhance different aspects of the learning process. One, it can activate prior learning, which is really useful. Secondly, it can focus on key concepts, it's useful. Thirdly, it can get students to think, you know, to analyze, compare and contrast, make inference interpretations, evaluate, critical thinking, not creative thinking. And it gives you a nice point where you can introduce new knowledge and connect in ways that is most effective. In other words, you don't need to teach stuff that the students already know well. Equally, you don't make it too difficult that they can't connect to it. Right. Now, that applies to every single e-tool. So I'm going to throw something back to you now. One thing that we worked on extensively in Singapore was there's all these e-tools, and each week you've introduced some. Let's bring it down to, in a sense, once you understand that those core principles, there's an e-tool enhance an aspect of the learning process. How can you combine these? You've got to say to yourself that in teaching, you're basically delivering information, right? Yep. You're interacting with information and you're assessing the impact on learning. So you can think about three genres. And then you can then look at e-tools that exist in those genres. And that's something that you can do exceptionally well, much better than me. But let's look at one is that as teachers, we're going to be extracting information and we're going to be developing instructional strategies using technology. So we might have a learning platform, could be Facebook, it could be a learning management system, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
The second thing is we want students to engage with that information and communicate, not just with us, but with their peers, because we know peer instruction, peer appraisal is powerful. So we want technology to enable students to talk, write, communicate with us and their peers, and even beyond that, why not students in other countries and etc. But we also need to check what learning is going on, so we need tools that can assess learning and make good diagnostic assessment in real time, and that's where learning analytics comes in. So if you've got any if teachers have got some e-tools across those three areas and they use them in an integrated manner, driven both in terms of design and facilitation by those heuristics of good pedagogy, right? Will these tools enhance aspects of the learning process? And if you can enhance all aspects of the learning process effectively and efficiently by a combined IT blending, so you've got a pedagogic Russian doll, you know, in Atty sense, you create an ICT enabled Russian doll. So good pedagogy with really thoughtful blending of technology with methods. That is where, and increasingly we're going to use things like augmented reality and things like that. That's going to be eye level teacher expertise in the coming years. And that's what we're trying to evolve that. It's a big jigsaw, it's complex, and it's a bit like medicine. You imagine that we had a medical science that could basically eliminate every single disease effectively and efficiently. Now, that's what I would call a really good medical system. So we're trying to do that in terms of pedagogy. At the moment, we've got barriers to working memory and, you know, many other things. And we're trying to say, how can we get students to learn the best they can, given our existing knowledge about how the brain works, and using the technology to connect to the best types of learning stimulus. So it's a big challenge, but that's what makes teaching a exciting profession. Not saying that at the operational level in schools where there's insufficient funding and, you know, all, a lot of things that are problematic in some educational systems, slightly less so in Singapore. And that's why, you know, I enjoyed my time there and have, and why it's been such a successful system. But it that's where we need to go.
Right. Okay.
What e-tools do you think are particularly good across those three genres? In fact, some of them can hit all three genres. So I'll throw that question to you for the rest of this podcast.
Yeah. So essentially, I think you have already covered the other two heuristics. So I'm going to summarize it by giving you a scenario of how I would put it together in terms of a ICT Russian doll. And I'll go back to the example that I alluded to earlier and how we make use of this technology. So if I was to do this, number one, and I'm going to use the core principles as the basis for how I'm choosing my e-tools and actually using it. So number one, to do a recap or to activate prior knowledge, what I would do would be is I would do a very simple quiz. If I wanted to make it fun, of course, I'll use Kahoot. Or I can use other tools like a Socrative rocket race, you know, where they have to answer correct questions and then there is a little race to get to the end. And of course, I would reward that behavior by maybe giving, you know, very simple things like, you know, like a little bit of, I like to give Starbucks coffee, not actually the real coffee, but, you know, the supermarkets, they have these little glass bottles that actually sell for, where they package little coffees. So I like to do that. And I think students, I don't think they really want to win the coffee. It's just that the thrill of winning becomes fun for them. So that's one. That's how I would activate prior knowledge. So that's the first e-tool I would use. Now, the second e-tool I would use is probably going to be a poll where I introduce the concept or the idea of what we will be talking about today. And every student, unless they come from underneath a rock, would have an opinion on, and I'll just use back the same topic I had before on sustainability. What does it mean to them at this particular point in time? Many people would have had different experiences, but I just wanted to establish a baseline of what sustainability means. So I'll do a little poll for them. And you can find these tools very easily, like Poll Everywhere or Mentimeter. And as you know, I only use free tools. I know some of these tools aren't free, but they are limited in the sense that you can only ask one or two questions. But it's good enough. So like Mentimeter, if you do a very simple poll, people can see in real time, you can ask that question. And again, if you want them to, it depends on what kind of thinking you want them to do. If it's just to establish a baseline, then it could be something as simple as what do you understand by the term sustainability, as opposed to if you really wanted them to go deeper, then you would get them to try and unearth their own belief systems of what sustainability is or what does it mean to them as a student. Okay. Now, then what I would do is go into the crux of the session, which is what I alluded to earlier. Use ChatGPT, immediately go and generate text about what sustainability is. And that's when I'll get them to now go into an activity where they can do debates. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What could be wrong about this? What could be better about it? And then to end it off with a last final tool as a sort of formative assessment to check on their understanding would be is I will, and I introduced this tool before, I will get them to go into Canva to create a very simple infographic to teach their juniors or a primary 5 or grade 5 student on what sustainability is based on all the activities that we did from the beginning of the class to the end of the class. That is all the kind of tools that I would use. So if I was to count back, number one, Kahoot to check for prior knowledge, poll to really get the thinking processes moving on, ChatGPT to get them to self-regulate their own thinking, getting them to think more critically and getting them to be problem solvers. And number four tool, which is Canva, to get them to creatively put all the information that they have learned together into a coherent whole. Make sense?
Yeah. And the question that I would throw at you, and I know you can answer this question, is that would apply to any other subject, wouldn't it, to some extent?
Yep.
Because it's core principles of learning. What does the student know? What do they believe and feel at a given time? And a way in which they can gather information. And that's where the tool you're talking about is so good at pulling relevant information where they haven't got to spend thousands of hours of discovering, getting frustrated, and we're putting the emphasis on, look, it's there now, but you've got to engage with it, you've got to think about it, you've got to really develop understanding of it and show application. So that applies, it doesn't matter what subject you teach, does it?
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Yeah, and so, yeah, you want to say something then?
Yeah. Yeah, and just one other thing is that don't think those four tools that you mentioned are all powerful, but what you need, it's like a restaurant. You can have one great meal and that might be enough, but the students could get habituated to using those four tools. So the idea is to have two or three, like you mentioned the Mentimeter as well and whatever, is to have three or four tools that are all within those genres, just to create that bit of variety. So in other words, I like chili crab, not every night, but once a week, it'd be great. So providing you've got a menu of tools that you can rotate, and some might be more appropriate to some aspects of learning certain subject areas than others. That's your toolkit, isn't it? That's pretty comprehensive.
Yep. Okay. So that's perfect. That just brings us nicely to the end of today's episode, the first one for 2023. Usually at this point, we introduce the tool, but we have done that today as the basis for our discussion. So what's happening then? Are you preparing to come to Singapore or something?
Yeah, well, basically, I leave Jersey on Saturday. Then I've got 2 days in England with my daughters. Then I fly on the 10th to Bangkok. I will then stay with a friend who works with me. You missed him. Good guy. Australian chap, works as an instructional designer. He lives there with his wife and daughter. So I will stay with him for a while. And then we may do a podcast from there. And then I will be going to Singapore, mate, and we will have face-to-face interactions. And maybe we should do a podcast while I'm in Singapore, outside some exotic location, eating local food. I won't need to wear a jumper.
We'll be eating beef rendang.
I mean, I can't wait. So basically, I'll see you in just over a week, I think, something right. Like that.
Okay, yeah. That's perfect. We look forward to having that conversation after the pandemic. And I'm pretty sure that will be a good recording. Let's just think of a good topic. So have a good flight to Singapore and we'll talk to you soon. So once again, for everyone, if this is your very first time that you're listening to us, you can write to us at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, it is evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Or if you want to participate in a podcast, you are welcome to do so as well. Please do write to us. So that ends the first episode for 2023. And we'll talk to you soon. So take care and goodbye.
And goodbye from me.